As if he didn't already have enough to do, former presidential candidate Sherrod Brown found time last year to publish a fascinating book, an in-depth profile of eight senators who preceded him in the chair he now occupies, the inspiring Desk 88, Eight Progressive Senators Who Changed America, has just been published in paperback, thanks to which the senator returns to State of Belief to discuss his predecessors as well as his role in today's federal legislature as the only Democrat currently holding statewide office in the entire state. Senator Brown, I've been looking forward to this ever since we hung up the last time. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
It's wonderful to be back, and just your show, I heard so many comments the last time, and you have so many fans out there. Thank you.
A paperback release is always a sign that the book has found its audience. What do you think it is about these profiles, particularly in an age when approval of elected lawmakers remains quite low, that's connecting so powerfully with readers?
I think they see this book is about eight senators who held the desk I now sit at in the Senate. And they had running through them a belief that government can actually make people's lives better, from rural electrification in the countryside to Medicare to Social Security to civil rights. And I think they all had hope for a better day. And so the paperback, the publisher asked me to do an afterword, because the book came out a year ago and they wanted something including the pandemic this year. And so I finished it in about August, but I wrote a chapter called Instill, Hope. And I think that people are looking for hope, and that's in these dark times. And I think the one thing that follows through this book is some of the best periods in our country have come out of periods of darkness preceding them, and that's what I feel like now will happen in the next couple of years.
Senator, is there one particular story that seems to have resonated with readers, or have you gotten that level of feedback since the book's release?
Boy, that's a hard question. I think probably the journey of Hugo Black, who was the first, the longest ago senator I profiled, and then the essay I wrote about him was very personal about my own family. My mother, like Hugo Black, was a child of the segregated South. Hugo Black was born in the 19th century. My mom was born 100 years ago, actually this year. And I think the journey that Hugo Black, from 1926 Senate race, where he was actually a member of the KKK, to 30 years later, after writing labor law in the Senate and then on the Supreme Court, an important writer of the Brown v. Board of Education to integrate schools. Black was burned in effigy in 1956, I believe, at his law school, in the law school he attended in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. So he went from a KKK member to burned in effigy because he was a leader in civil rights. I think people like that kind of arc. They saw it with Al Gore Sr., who had a mixed, but not a terrible, but a mixed record on civil rights. And by the end, he took on Johnson, his own party, on Vietnam. He took on Nixon, won the Supreme Court. He supported voting rights, and he was defeated in the next election, knowing that he very well might be by taking those positions. So I think people appreciate the courage of, and I think there is something that perhaps people in politics later in their career sometimes get a little more courage when they realize what's at stake, and maybe they're no longer interested in running for president. That might be part of it too. I don't know.
Well, you know, I have read Justice Black a lot because he had some really good things to say about religious freedom, and there are not a lot of people talking about religious freedom.
Yeah, that's right, and I didn't talk a lot about that in the book. But he was, I didn't talk much about his Supreme Court times. I mean, his work in religious freedom was that part of his life.
Yeah.
He was in the Senate, not even two full terms, and he was Roosevelt's first Supreme Court nominee and he stayed on longer than all but one other senator, I think, or one other court justice, I think. But his time on the court was what made his name so well known. But when he was in the Senate, he wrote the collective bargaining bill with Senator Wagner of New York that gave people ultimately the 8-hour day and minimum wage. So he had a major impact on workers in the Senate and on religious and civil liberties and race and mm-hmm. racial equality on the court. Quite a career.
As many of us look in horror at the developments taking shape in our nation's capital, I can't help but wonder what some of the legendary lawmakers profiled in your book would have to say about what's going on, in particular about the dynamic of power among the coequal branches of government. I imagine that you have done some thinking about that.
Yeah, they would, as you obviously have. They would have been the party labels meant a little bit different then. That both parties had a wider swath of ideology. I mean, the Democrats in many of these years also had there were segregationist Democrats in the Senate. Segregationists. They belonged to the Democratic Party. Now, people with that ideology have left, and they're Republicans. There used to be more liberal Republicans, so there were more conservative Democrats. There used to be more liberal Republicans, and that's how civil rights passed, essentially. But I think any one of these senators would look with some sadness upon the degradation of the institution of the Senate, and as you said, the coequal branches of government. I mean, the Senate leadership essentially does whatever Donald Trump wants them to. I've never seen a president have this kind of power over his party members in the Congress, and not just power on legislatively, but failure to be sure of to criticize, but fear of them. I mean, I saw it during impeachment. The last chapter I wrote, the afterword, is about impeachment, but mostly about the coronavirus and about hope for the future. But during impeachment, the fact that only one Republican voted to allow witnesses to come to the Senate floor and speak about the impeachment. I mean, not even witnesses, because I could see the fear in their eyes. They knew Trump would come to their states and campaign against them. And we've never seen, I mean, that wasn't that way with Bush. It wasn't that way with Obama. And that's tragic in my mind, that because of that, the Senate simply doesn't legislate much anymore.
Yeah. Your book profiles 8 progressive senators. I wonder if you would talk about the shifting nature of progressive identity and the strategies your predecessors brought to bear on the greatest challenges of their time. And with that, what does it mean for you to talk about an elected leader to live out a progressive set of values in 2020?
That's a lot of questions packed into that, Dr. Getty. So, I first of all, understand all these 8 senators, all of them were white men. They all look like me. They are, because that's who was in the Senate most of these years, right, starting in 1926. I think they, progressivism was, what the common thread of all of them is standing up to private power, that progressives believe that that almost by nature of self-government, the people with the most power and privilege and influence will have the most power and privilege and influence in the power and influence in the government, and that you need a group of senators and House members to push back. I came across a quote from Emerson. Emerson believed, and I think he's right about all of the sweep of history, that history's made up of the self-government's a contest between, Emerson said, the conservators and the innovators. The conservators are privileged people who hold on to their power, hold their power close to their chests, and don't want to give it up. The innovators, the progressives, want to try to move the country forward. That's the age-old battle. Every one of these senators engaged in that battle, to be sure. Some did it more aggressively. Some called themselves progressives. They all didn't call themselves that. But I think that's that's the lesson I take and the way that I do my job. And 2020 is no different that way from 1920. I mean, there are other the issues have changed. The issues of race have certainly changed. The people who sit in the halls of power have changed, obviously, over 100 years individually, but they've changed sort of demographically, too, to a point. But that's sort of the goal, to move in that direction.
Senator Brown, you've been transparent with your voters and with your readers about your role models and about who inspires you. I wonder if that's a conversation you've had with some of your fellow lawmakers. Do you have a sense of what figures inspire some of the most important positions and convictions on the Hill today, or have things just become more short-term, more transactional in recent years?
We don't talk about among ourselves enough about history. My love for history, I think, informs my job. I mean, because I like history and because I read history, I think I do history of this body and American government history of the last 100 years. It helps me do my job better. I'm not casting aspersions on colleagues, but I don't know that many of us think much about that, and we don't talk about it a whole lot. Many of my colleagues read the book and talked to me about it. But I think in terms of history, this is probably a time, you know, of heroes and or role models. This is a time of not a time that we think a lot about heroes in our country, I think, but surely the passing of John Lewis really piqued people's interest in that, because so many of us held him out as, none of us knows personally many heroes, people we call heroes, except for a parent or, you know, a local person that's done heroic things in different ways that we maybe model ourselves after. But I think John Lewis and Dr. King, a number of my colleagues quote King pretty regularly. So I guess I would say them, but I don't hear it much. I don't see it much. Discussion about it.
Well, I want to stay with history for a moment because I think a historical perspective is so critical at this moment when so much of our politics is happening in tweets and online video clips. What would you or your predecessors at Desk 88 counsel the American people to keep in mind for the sake of perspective and stability?
Well, before the pandemic, I think I wrote in the original hardback, it's still there, but I added the chapter later, that don't romanticize history. I mean, the Senate in the 1950s, 95 white men and one white woman couldn't pass civil rights. So let's not look at the past is always so much better, because the tendency is romanticize history. So I don't think we should do that. I think history should always inform us. And I think that, again, we don't think enough about it. We don't talk to each other enough about it. I think we can learn from the growth of Hugo Black and Al Gore, and the initial courage of Herbert Lehman and Glenn Taylor for the characters, the senators in the book. But I think it's always important that our society realize that this. What I was going to say in the book, that this wasn't the darkest time in our history. I said that before the pandemic. Maybe it's really is the darkest time now in my lifetime. But I think the lesson is, out of dark times emerge some pretty good times. Out of the Depression emerged FDR and all that he did to build these institutions of minimum wage and collective bargaining and rural electrics and Social Security that we all benefit from forever. So I would keep emphasizing, as I do to my colleagues, that this is a time, even though it's dark, that times will be better, and we need to use the new times to build institutions from which we can benefit for decades.
Senator, I am profoundly worried about what's coming on November 3rd, and even more about what's coming in the days that follow. Do you think that I and millions of other Americans are being too alarmist?
I think that being alarmist doesn't help. I understand the fears and the concerns, and I watched that debate. I mean, what I took out of the debate was that Donald Trump didn't want to talk about his record on the coronavirus and on the economy, so he wanted the conversations to be about interruptions and behavior and anger and all that, and he succeeded in part. But I understand. I think the best answer to being alarmist, and we all share those fears, we all do, of what could happen, is to blunt that from happening by everybody individually voting early as much as possible, either in person early, early voting the month for the elections. You can do in Ohio starting next week, and many other states are voting absentee early. The Postal Service can handle it. There is no scandal in mail-in voting. What the president says simply isn't true. Mm-hmm. Every elections official knows that. And I think that the other thing we need to do is a decisive presidential election. I make the case that my state, which wasn't considered very winnable because Trump won it by 8 points, now it's looking very, very close, and we win a state, and Biden wins a state like Ohio. I know this isn't a political show in that sense, but if Biden wins a state, wins the state of Ohio, he will likely have an electoral college landslide. That will diminish your reasons to be alarmed. That will blunt some of Trump's post-election tactics.
Is there an overarching message from the lives and careers of the legislators in your book that would be useful to keep in mind as we go through these next weeks?
Yeah, the country will see a better day. I mean, the history so ebbs and flows that standing up for your beliefs, standing up to private power, standing up to oppression and racism, we live for a better day. I think that's probably the lesson. But I know that, again, people feel that this is a dark time. It is. People feel alarmed, and there are reasons. But there is, I mean, I really am convinced from the lessons of this book that we will be in another progressive era, probably starting in 2021, and we will deal with the major moral issues of our time, climate, racial disparity, structural racism, and income inequality. Those three issues, income inequality, structural racism, and climate, and that those are what our country cries out for us to do.
The Honorable Sherrod Brown is currently serving his third term as the senior senator from Ohio. His inspiring book has just been published in a paperback edition. You need to get it. You will learn from it and even be inspired by it. Senator Brown, I'm always glad when you're coming this way, and I hope we'll get to do it again. Thank you for today.
And surely we will. And you ask about the most probing questions I've ever been asked about this book and much of anything else. So thank you, Dr. Gaddy. You really make me think.
Well, thank you, sir.
I need some time off now to rest my mind after that.